Hello and welcome to this week's Innovation Forum briefing. I'm Ian Welsh. We're back in Amsterdam this week for the European leg of our Future of Food and Beverage conference series. To find out what to expect, I caught up a few days ago with my colleague Hannah Oborn. That's coming up a bit later. First though, some further reflections from the recent Sustainable Apparel and Textiles conference, also in Amsterdam. At the conference I spoke with Mauro Scalia from Eurotex about the future for fast fashion and the role of policy. Before that, though, is a conversation I had with Hassan Uzzaman, Corporate Responsibility Manager at Aldi Süd, about human rights risks in the apparel sector. Why don't you give us a quick introduction to the work of Aldi Süd?
So Aldi Süd Group is a German-based retailer with a presence over 11 countries with 6,000-plus store operations, where we have 1,500-plus core range of product that we sell to our store, and every week there is a special buy. As far as sustainability is a concern, we focus on the human rights aspect of it. We have a focus on the carbon footprint, climate scope 1, 2, 3, animal welfare, food waste, and everything.
We've been talking just now in a session about supply chain risk mapping in terms of human rights. What are your priorities in terms of human rights risks?
In terms of human rights risk, we have a very vast and diverse supply chain, but we also know that with the resources that we have, it is not possible to go in everywhere. The approach we have that we conduct a risk assessment to understand what are the commodity groups with a more high-risk priority or high-risk commodity group, or more intervention into those specific product category, for example, textile, shoes, home textile, toys. Yeah. Throughout our intervention, we are having the supplier, CR supplier evaluation process as a part of that process, because our buying model is a bit different. Is the Aldi, then is the supplier or intermediaries, and followed by the production facilities. So our buying process is a bit complex to address the need of our buying process and also to address the risk of our supply chain. We have this year supplier evaluation process where we evaluate our suppliers annually through our audit intervention. And those results, yearly results, are integrated into our buying decisions so that buying team can make more like informed decision that which are a supplier that we should be partnering in the long term, and that also helps in the long term to address the sustainability risk in our supply chain. When it comes to the priority level, we want to understand the risk of our supply chain. That comes through the supply chain mapping. We are also focusing more, or gradually trying to focus more, on the improving purchasing practices, because that is a key to really make a sustainable approach to address those need. Or risk.
In the session we had just now, you were very open about some of the really significant human rights challenges you have in your supply chain. How easy has it been internally to get buy-in from senior management that you are allowed to say that you have these risks, yep, and that you are then talking about how you're going to address them rather than denying they are there?
In many occasions, we have seen that it's the SEER team, the sustainability team, they know the risk because they're very closely working with the supply chain. They try to drive the program by themselves. But at a certain point of time, we realize that's really not sustainable until unless you have a buy-in from your top managements, you have a buy-in from your buying colleagues. From a sustainability team, under the leadership of our managing director, we advocated and influenced our senior leadership that why we should be doing it. It's just not because of the legislation, but we as a responsible sourcing brand, well, we also want that our products are made more ethically and sustainable way. And of course, there are upcoming legislation. So that really helped us to get a buy-in from our top management and our buying colleagues. And that make really life our easy to do the next steps. And then we are onboarding our suppliers with the aligned message and communication that why we should be doing it. Because if we and our business partners are not aligned, then no matter what we do, that will not reach to our production facility level. Because end of the day, if they're open and transparent, that's what will give us a kind of a complete visibility of our supply chain. And that exactly happened what we did in India to see what are the risks in our supply chain and how we should address it.
We talked a bit about, in the session, use of social auditing. It's something that has been criticized for years, but it still seems as it's the best tool that we have, or amongst the best tools that we have. How much do you rely on social auditing?
If we look into our current intervention model, auditing is playing a vital role. We also believe that auditing cannot bring the only solution. There are some other interventions model. But still, the auditing method that we have adopted and the way we are working with supplier and factory, it's just not about the fact-finding, the true fact-finding, the transparency approach. and really not to go for a penalization instantly unless there is a very adverse level of human rights impact into the supply chain. So we are trying to building the capacity for suppliers and factory through that audit process. We give them a reasonable amount of time to address those needs. It's just not the cut and run approach. So building that trust, building that capacity is helping us to really see the real scenarios. And then we are trying to adopt some other models, for example, training, supplier training, capacity building, training to the production facility levels, introducing different other systems and process to go for a long-term sustainability. But still, audit is playing a vital role, provided how you are making the whole supply chain and the business partner transparent.
You mentioned earlier that consumers are expecting brand accountability now on these sort of issues. Do you think that's going to help drive forward better supply chain transparency and reduce the impact of human rights risks on supply chains?
Absolutely, because everything that we do is for the consumers, right? And of course, there are some other pressing demands coming from the different civil society organizations, stakeholders, and of course, legislation. What we feel, and we have a motto that's make sustainability affordable for everyone. So the consumers are the key stakeholders of ours. And if we, whatever the product that we deliver and sell it to them, we also feel is a urge that we are transparent with them. If there is no demand from the consumers, ultimately nothing is going to change. We feel this is going to prevail and there will be much more need to address the consumers' demand.
And certainly, consumer attitudes are changing, and as we go forward, it'll be interesting to see how much they drive forward this agenda. But for now, Hassan Uzzaman from Ali Sud, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Now here's Eurotech's Director of Sustainable Business, Mauro Scalia, on fast fashion and policy.
We are the European Textile and Apparel Industry Confederation, based in Brussels. Our job is to represent the interests of 190,000 companies from across the value chain, from fiber to finished product, vis-a-vis the European Union institution and other international fora, in policy making especially.
So we were talking earlier about the EU and their objectives to end fast fashion. 2030 has been the deadline that's been discussed. Do you think that's achievable? The negative sides of fast fashion, can that be dealt with by 2030?
I like the point you just made, the negative side of fast fashion. I mean, a lot of people talk about fast fashion in different angles. There is no legal definition of that. We heard that this morning. What is clear is that the EU wants to change how textiles are made, chosen, and disposed of. Whether it would be about home textile or especially garment, there are a lot of different legislative action under development, which indeed want to work on the quality of the product, on how consumers choose product, what are the emission release in the production of the product. So there is really a lot happening. We cannot yet say whether all of these goals will be achieved, but clearly we can expect tremendous transformation in the value chain and hopefully also in how consumers choose sustainable products in the next few years.
What are the milestones we should be looking out for then on the route to 2030?
One of the most important pieces of legislation is the eco-design regulation. And then we're going to see a process which will continue to develop the specific requirements for information and for the actual product requirements that will be mandatory for product to be sold in the EU. Somebody say as by 2027, 2028. So this is going to be a crucial year, development requirements, the next year to test it. In the next 3 to 4 years, this should become mandatory. That's, I think, one of the most important milestones.
Is that what your members want to see?
Our members want to see attention to competitiveness. We are now completing the Ursula von der Leyen commission cycle, political cycle. There is a lot of attention being placed, and rightfully so, on sustainability. But we do say you cannot have sustainability if you don't have also the attention to competitiveness. We need to have market surveillance, better market surveillance. We need to have level playing field. Businesses competing at equal level. We need to have a demand for sustainable products. Our members are ready to engage and to continue invest in sustainability. As long as there is a demand for that, and as long as there is equal and fair conditions in the market to use and sell sustainable goods.
So how much of this then is about a drive to quality?
That's indeed one of the major things eco-design wants to change. Technically speaking, today in the EU, you can sell products, garments, of any kind of quality. As long as you don't have toxic chemicals, for instance, you can do that. And there would be the market, normal consumers, which will decide whether to buy again your product or not. What this legislation wants to do, and we strongly ask for that, is to set minimum requirement when it comes to, for instance, durability of a product. So if you can set a few parameters in terms of quality that can help, that I can forbid, place low quality products in the market, that could be a tremendous advantage for the environment, for the consumers, and for the competitive business as well.
So how are you working with the European Commission then to achieve these goals?
Well, I think policymakers know that they cannot do this legislation alone. That's a really good thing, which is not taken for granted, because we've seen a lot of initiative in some member states where things happen very, very fast, which might please some, but perhaps they're not as solid in terms of scientific foundation or technical arguments. The EU institutions make a lot of consultations. They call it stakeholder consultation, public consultation. There are technical bodies involved, scientists from the so-called Joint Research Center. We do speak with the policymakers, and we do participate in this consultation on, I would say, a weekly basis. We have a frequent dialogue to understand what the questions are, sometimes it's not that easy, and to provide technical inputs. How do we get this input? We speak to all our members, and therefore, in a cascade, we basically speak with all the European industry in a representative manner, of course. So there is this constant dialogue between policymaker, technicians, and industry, which we believe is essential to find the right quality parameters and to find the right way of making the law.
Well, there's certainly a lot to do if the 2030 goals are to be achieved. It'd be interesting to see how progress continues over the coming years. But for now, Mario Scalia from Eurotex, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
As I mentioned earlier, Innovation Forum is back in Amsterdam this week for the first in our Future of Food and Beverage conference series. I spoke with event director Hannah O'Born. So we're in Amsterdam this week. How's the event coming together?
It's coming together really nicely. I'm really looking forward to it.
Any last minute additions to the agenda?
On the afternoon of day one, we will be running our breakouts and fifth room sessions. Within these breakouts, we have added a more interactive track. These sessions will take various formats such as workshops and case studies. The goal is really to encourage more engaging and proactive discussions. One example is our Digital Revolution in Farming workshop, where we will hear from a tea farmer in Kenya discussing the key barriers he is facing within digital adoption in farming. The audience will then split into smaller groups to engage with more specific questions and feedback to the wider group.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm running that session alongside Jason Archie from Producers Direct. Really interesting and engaging session, all framed by the comments from our farmer in Kenya. So looking forward to that. What should delegates expect at the event then?
So we have lots of exciting additions to look forward to this year. We'll be running our fifth room sessions on day one. These are really a safe space for discussion on some of the more controversial topics. This year, we will be looking at topics such as the future of farming, EU agricultural policy, ultra-processed foods, and regenerative agriculture. Lots to get stuck into. These sessions are sign-up only and spaces are limited. So please feel free to download our conference app to register for these.
All's very popular. It's really interesting and engaging conversations. A number of those will be led by my colleague Toby Webb. Very much worth attending those sessions if you're coming to the event. Any logistical points that delegates need to know?
We will be running a pre-registration drinks reception on Monday the 13th between 5:30 and 6:30 at the lower bar in Hotel Casa. And we'll be running a happy hour during this time, so attendees can join us for a drink and collect their badge ahead of time. We'll have over 200 people attending the conference, so it's a really great chance to skip the queue and also meet with fellow attendees.
Yeah, it's always very nice to have a bit of a get-together ahead of the event. Are there any on-the-day details that would be helpful for anyone attending in Amsterdam?
This conference will be entirely paperless, so attendees can download our Innovation Forum conference app to keep up to date with everything going on across the 2 days. From the app, attendees will be able to connect with other attendees, view the agenda in live time, register for fifth room sessions, and also engage with our farmer-led content. The Innovation Forum conference app can be downloaded from any app store, but please do get in touch if you have any questions.
Yeah, the app's very useful for finding a way around the event and also seeing who is attending. Worth saying that if you're in Amsterdam next week and you find yourself available to join us, we're happy to accept any walk-ups. There's still a bit of space. Just come and see any of the Innovation Forum team at the registration desk. Hannah, looking forward to it very much.
Thanks, Ian.
If you're going to be in Amsterdam at the conference this week, do come and say hi. It's always great to catch up with podcast listeners. We'll be back on Thursday with this week's podcast. However, for now, I've been Ian Welsh and goodbye.